dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people alive today who have done more, I would argue, and done more consistently over decades to advance the cause of freedom, to do it in creative, innovative, and inspiring ways, and with significant impact, not only in the moment, but for the generations that followed, than our first guest. I'm proud to say he's a friend as well as an inspiration and mentor to me. His name is Richard Viguerie. He is one of the founding fathers of the modern conservative movement. He is, by trade, an extremely successful marketing innovator. He is the founder of American Target Advertising. Really invented, I think it's fair to say, the whole direct marketing industry, and he has been active in conservative and Republican politics for, well, 60-odd years, I think it's correct to say. We've asked him to join us today to talk about something that he has described as an exceedingly dangerous piece of legislation. We have been following it closely here at Secure Freedom Radio now for several weeks, and I wanted to ask Richard to talk with you all in the hope that you might yet help elevate your concerns about what has been called the For the People Act, better known by its bill number H.R. 1, with those who represent you in Congress. Because, in his words, quote, if H.R. 1 becomes law, every issue you care about will be lost forever, unquote. Richard Viguerie, that is a very strong warning indeed, and one that I'm anxious to have you expand on. Welcome to Securing Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us, sir.
Well, thank you, Frank, my friend. It's great to be with you, and I can't thank you enough for your interest in discussing H.R. 1 and S.1, because I'm afraid so many of our friends are just oblivious to the danger that we face if H.R. 1 and S.1 and the Senate version becomes law. Let me just briefly refer to your introduction. Thank you for that kind introduction. I jokingly refer to myself sometimes as 002, which means I've been active at the national level of the conservative movement longer than every living conservative except for Dr. Lee Edwards at the Heritage Foundation. You know, Goldwater, Buckley, Falwell, all these greats came before us have passed on. So I'm still here, and I'm 87 years old. I go 12, 13 hours a day, 5.5 days a week. Love every minute. I've been blessed with good health. And so anyway, I'm doing what I can, as you are. But this is the ball game, Frank. The Democrats are able to change our election laws, they will have established, in essence, a one-party dictatorship. And that's their goal. That's their agenda. They're not like Republicans who kind of say, stay the course. I mean, these people are want to change our rules and laws so that Republicans will never be competitive at the national level again. It makes it illegal to request a photo ID to vote. Makes it illegal to request any form of identification. It does away with early registration. You can walk up election day, say, I want to register, and by the way, I live across the town or the street or whatever, and you can't ask for any identification. It requires all states to adopt a California-style ballot harvesting, which means that people go to nursing homes, assisted livings, apartment units, and collect hundreds and hundreds of ballots. And they can show up 5, 6, 7, 8 days after the election, up to 10 days after the election, with these ballots. 7 Republican congressmen went to sleep election night in 2018 with anywhere from a 2,000 to a 5,000 vote lead. Every one of them lost when the votes were all counted because people were showing up days afterwards, boxes in their trunks there. And it just it goes on and on and on.
I'm fond of saying, Richard, that if you liked the 2020 elections, you're going to love H.R. 1 because, as I understand it, it essentially codifies all of the things that the Democrats used to engage in what certainly seems to me to have been electoral grand larceny. And that would make it permanent, not just for the next election, but forever. And that's to your point about, you know, a permanent one-state majority.
It allows 16-year-olds to register. Now, they can't vote till they're 18, but it allows them to register. And we know what these 16, 17-year-old kids are going to do. They're going to vote, and you cannot question the vote. It's illegal to question and challenge the vote. They've sent it all to Washington. If you have a concern with somebody in Arizona, Texas, voting illegally, you have to send a request to Washington, and a Washington bureaucracy controlled by the Democrats going to want to rule on that. They have a speech czar. I have got 20 clients in my agency, Frank, and they're all conservative ideological organizations. But it will be illegal for me to have more than one ideological client because we would be considered as colluding. So if I'm a printer and I've got lots of candidates running for federal office as clients, I can only have one, because if I have two, then I'm considered to be colluding with the two campaigns. This is the most evil bill. You said it well yesterday. It's the worst bill in the history of the world.
And when you look at this, Richard, again, just to drill down on certain pieces of this, because I think it's so important to understand, it has to do with every aspect of our political life. It's yes, the voting process, but as you say, it's also speech, it's also fundraising, it's also the you know, sort of rights of, you know, assembly, freedom of assembly, in a sense, too. It's hard to imagine how overreaching this bill could be, and how perilously close we are to its enactment. There is expected to be, I'm told, a vote on it as soon as perhaps tomorrow night, Wednesday night, maybe Thursday morning. There are clearly challenges to, you know, this kind of bill being enacted in full if it goes over to the Senate, as we expect it will. But Richard Viguerie, to the extent that Americans listening to this program want to know what they can do about it, what would your advice be? Very quickly, and then we'll pick up on the other side of a short break.
Two things, Frank. One, write, call, visit, email members of Congress in your state, not just in your congressional district, your House member, every single House member in your state, call, write, and then tell them you are going to do the same thing. You're going to contact your family members, your friends, your neighbors, your co-workers, and you're going to tell them how bad this bill is, and you're all going to watch how they vote. So it's not only taking action themselves, but they need to be Paul Revere's, going out there and spreading the word, because this is America.
Richard, hold the thought. Hold the thought. We're going to come right back on the question of whether we're going to survive all this. Richard Viguerie is in the House virtually. I'm thrilled to say he has taken time to raise the alarm to be the Paul Revere. We need to emulate him. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're continuing this really important conversation with Richard Viguerie, an iconic leader of the conservative movement in America, and a man who, like E.F. Hutton, when he speaks, people listen. And he is speaking very, very aggressively about the danger that he sees, I think quite correctly, arising from a piece of legislation designed to essentially lock in electoral fraud and the dominance that it enables of a permanent Democratic majority in the Congress and in the White House. The end of free and fair elections, it's been called. And this is, of course, the bill known as the For the People Act, H.R. 1 in the House, S.1 in the Senate. And Richard, I hated to interrupt you, but you were just beginning to make a point that I hope you'll conclude your thought about, you know, what is on the line here in terms of our constitutional republic.
Yeah, it's a license to steal, and as you say, they call it the For the People Act. It's really for the Democrat Party. And when the listeners call and talk to members of Congress, particularly the Democrats, House members, Senate members, present this not as a battle and disagreement between Democrats and Republicans or conservatives and liberals. This is un-American. This is unfair. I've often said Americans are nothing if they are not about fairness. Americans really want to be fair. And this is not fair. This is un-American. And by the way, don't just call their Washington, D.C. office. You can actually probably have more impact if you call the district office. They don't get a lot of mail there. And so call the district office and tell them you're not only calling for yourself, you're going to be calling your family, friends, neighbors, co-workers, church members, and you're going to be Paul Revere and tell others out there, and we want to shut down these switchboards. We want to shut down their mailrooms here. And by the way, it's so exciting to see the...
If I may just interrupt for a second, one of the things that I think is so important for people to understand, it may seem as though your call, your email, your visit to the, especially as you say, the district office may not make a difference. Yet I understand, Richard, that those congressional offices calculate that for everyone who actually does one of those things, there is a multiplier of perhaps 1,000 to 1 or more, maybe, of people that they believe are likely of a similar mind in their constituency. So it has a huge impact if you do what Richard is suggesting here, folks, and that is enlist, you know, not only your own immediate family and your own efforts, of course, but those of your extended circles of influence. It can make an outsized difference. And Richard, just one thing you touched on that I think is particularly important. This is expected to be a party line vote, I think, and there are only, you know, 4 or 5 Democratic votes that need to be switched in order for this not to go down, as Nancy Pelosi hopes it will. You're an expert at political matters. Do you believe that these Democrats in districts that Donald Trump carried, of whom there are some 20 or more, are susceptible to this kind of effort by constituents, particularly their own constituents, of course, if they do hear from them in numbers?
Absolutely, Frank. And you can go to my website, conservativehq.com, and I've got a list of actually 45 who won by the most narrow margins, the ones that won just by a few votes, 100 votes, 1,000 votes. And so if you call them, and by the way, if you don't live anywhere close to them, I bet you've got family there. I bet you got friends, classmates, whatever it might be, who live in that area. Call them. And we all need to not only make calls ourselves, but be Paul Revere's and spread the alarm. And the President Sunday night was urging us to do that. He spent an enormous amount of time talking about this bill because he understands the importance of it. And he was urging everybody to reach out and contact their members of Congress, particularly the Democrats.
I wanted to come next to that speech, Richard, because I know you've heard a fair number of them in your time. What did you make of not just his appeal for election integrity, based in part on his own hard experience in this last cycle, but on, as you say, the stakes for the future? If we don't get this right, it is the end of our republic, no doubt about it. But more generally, what did you make of his substance as well as, you know, his delivery of this important address at this particular moment in time.
Well, it was, you know, vintage Trump. He had something that very few conservative leaders have, and that's called energy. And most of our friends, Frank, out there, we love them. We know, you and I know just about all of them at the national level, many at the state level. They just don't have the energy out there. And it just, I've heard Donald Trump, as you have, speak, where he says, things standing between the average conservative and the loss of their freedoms and liberty is Donald J. Trump. Quite frankly, I never thought I would say that, you know, but the point of the spear protecting us right now is Donald J. Trump. And we need to follow his leadership and get out there and bring energy to the fight. It's like our people have just the leadership, not the grassroots. The grassroots is on fire. I've never seen them so energized, Frank. But they need something. They need something when I came to New York to run Young Americans for Freedom in 1961, and they need it today, and that's called leadership.
Let me ask you about this, Richard, because obviously one of the things that the president spoke to and we are all wrestling with is it's not simply that there's a lack of leadership, an energetic, conservative, robust leadership. There are a few, but not nearly enough in elective office, particularly at the federal level. But there is a very strong contingent within that group. The president said it was a handful. Unfortunately, it's, I think, larger, or a very big handful, at least, of elected officials, especially in the Senate of the United States and the House, who are, yes, Republican, but generally, they're of an establishment character, not a conservative one. They're not energetically pursuing the kind of agenda for freedom that's needed, especially in the face of this this hostile and aggressive radical leftist dominated Democratic Party. And, you know, one of the things that's just been striking about this is that we've witnessed this seeming controlled opposition phenomenon taking place in Republican circles. And I'm thinking of Liz Cheney as a prime example of it, Mitch McConnell seemingly in recent days as well. What are your thoughts about, you know, the direction of the party, what the president said about not starting a new one, but establishing the dominance of the, well, great American character that he has spoken to so powerfully? And represented.
Yeah. The Frank, I will say this, as bad as it is now, and it is bad, we've come a long way since the time when I started in early 1960s and when Nelson Rockefeller ran the Republican Party. And then after him, it was Richard Nixon. Exactly, and Gerry Ford. They were the big government Republicans, and now everybody says they're a conservative. But too many conservatives, particularly at the national level, Frank, have acted as an arm of the Republican Party. They've acted as an appendage of the party instead of being constitutional, limited government conservatives, independent of the Republican Party. We should act like, in my opinion, like a third force where we pull the Republicans and the Democrats our way. The Democrats have tens of thousands of third force organizations. Think of all the unions out there, the race-based organizations, the environmentalists, et cetera, pulling everybody their way. And that's what conservatives should do. We should operate within the Republican Party, but pull everybody our ways. Remember James Carville in 1992, I like to paraphrase him when he said, "It's the economy, stupid." I say to conservatives, "It's the primaries, stupid. It's the primaries." And we have a lot of open Senate seats coming up here in 2 years. So we need to be focused on the primaries. In many ways, Frank, we are, as conservatives, like the biblical Jews who had to wander through the desert for 40 years until that generation of failed, flawed leaders had passed from the scene. And we need new leadership, mostly younger leadership, because too many of our friends have become an arm of the GOP, an appendage of the GOP. And with Trump's leadership, I think that we have the chance to make the GOP the Great American Party, as you say. I like that name.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I hope that will come to pass. and you're right, and you understand this better than just about anybody alive, Richard Viguerie, what it takes to both energize that base and to get it focused on, you know, the nuts and bolts of the party machinery and building the infrastructure, really, to have a governing majority. And I think the opportunity is there. There's no question about it, including, by the way, in some of the Democratic circles, in some independent circles as well, needless to say. But it does take leadership, and you have been providing it brilliantly for a lifetime, Richard Viguerie. It's an honor to be able to, well, have you with us to say in this form personally, thank you for all of your tireless efforts to help guide us in these difficult moments. And I think with your vision on most immediately this H.R. 1 legislation, and on the future course of what I hope will be known henceforth as the Great America Party, not the Grand Old Party, the Republicans will rise to the challenge of our time. God bless you, sir. Thank you for joining us and for taking time from what I know is a very busy period for you. Keep up the great work, my friend. Many, many years of continued leadership and success. God bless you.
Thank you, Brent. Thank you for your leadership.
Thank you. Next up, we'll speak with Victoria Coates about Middle East policy and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a special privilege to say we're joined by a friend as well as a much admired colleague, a new fellow of the Center for Security Policy, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, a woman who brings to that position a host of important previous experiences, notably as National Security Advisor to Senator Ted Cruz, Deputy National Security Advisor to the President of the United States on the National Security Council, and Senior Policy Advisor to then Secretary of Energy Dan Brouillette. Her name is Victoria Coates, and we're always delighted to have a chance to visit with her, especially on an occasion when part of the world that she has spent a lot of time working on over the years, the Middle East, is very much front and center in American foreign policy making. Victoria, it's good to have you with us. Thank you, and welcome to the Center for Security Policy. We're delighted to have you aboard.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's a pleasure to be with you both on the airwaves and at the center.
Thank you. It seems to me the best way to characterize what the Biden team is doing with respect to the Middle East is not Trump. Basically, anything he was doing, they're not going to do. And the things he declined to do, for generally very good reasons, they are doing. Does that seem fair as a shorthand way of characterizing it? And how is that manifesting itself? That ought to give a lot of us pause.
Yeah, I think that's a good shorthand for their policy writ large. In the Middle East, to my eye, it all boils down to the Obama nuclear deal. That is the only thing that seems to have their interest in the region. They don't care about things like the Abraham Accords, all the good that was done in terms of promoting peaceful coexistence between our Israeli and Gulf allies. All they care about is getting back in the nuclear deal. And so that's driving every decision, regardless of realities on the ground.
And it manifests itself, I guess, in two ways, sort of at the macro level. One is, I sort of talked about this in my commentary today, alienating ourselves from our friends in the hope of endearing ourselves to our enemies, specifically the Islamic Republic of Iran's mullahs. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia and, I guess, the United Arab Emirates as well at this juncture, and what the administration seems to be determined to do to not simply distance ourselves from those two Gulf allies, but really to drive them away.
No, they do seem bent on precisely that. And I think you have a lot of people who have gone back into this administration from previous Democrat administrations up to and including John Kerry, who insisted for decades that you could not have peace in the Middle East without the resolution of the Palestinian issue. And what the Trump administration demonstrated over, particularly over the last 18 months, is that that's simply not true. And so you have people who built their careers on a falsehood. And what they're doing now is continuing to insist that Israel must be the problem in the region, that this peace is illusory and the only way towards any kind of lasting resolution to conflict in the Middle East has to go through Tehran. And that simply makes no sense. It's what's driving all of these decisions, such as delisting the Houthi as terrorists. You know, I feel bad for Secretary Blinken, who's had to put out three separate statements on Houthi terrorist attacks, the most recent of which was yesterday, since he announced his decision to delist them. They seem determined to prove him wrong. But, you know, that all of these decisions are not driven by reality. They're driven by the desire to appease the mullahs and somehow get back into the nuclear deal.
Rubbing our nose in concessions we're making is sort of standard operating procedure, I think it's fair to say, for the Iranians and, others in the Middle East. You know, they don't have any respect for weakness. And I think that's what's certainly being exhibited here. But talk a little bit more about the Houthis. It was really stunning to me that I think in that first batch, that onslaught of executive orders, one of the things that the president made much of was his commitment, his determination to pursue, you know, an end to the conflict in Yemen on what seemed like Iranian terms. Do you see it that way, Victoria Coates?
If the administration, are not going to have any dealings with the Saudis or the UAE, the only terms they have at Yemen are the Iranian terms, because the Iranians are the ones who are pushing the narrative. The Iranians are the ones who are training, equipping, and supporting the Houthi as they corner a million refugees. The most hopeless, the most forsaken folks almost on earth. I mean, obviously, we have the Uyghurs in China and others, so I don't want to make light of that. But, I mean, it is a catastrophe in Yemen, and the people who are deciding who eats and who doesn't eat are the Iranians. That's their choice. So it's really a shame that the president and his administration would forsake these folks as well and abandon them to a terrorist enterprise like the Houthi.
The other piece of it, though, Victoria, which again you understand well, I think most of us couldn't find Yemen on a map if we had to. But one of the things that is making, I fear, the impact of these decisions on the U.S.-Saudi relationship so fraught is Saudi Arabia has actually been attacked now, including Riyadh, by missiles launched from Houthi-held territory in Yemen. And that threat to people who have been more or less aligned with us almost certainly is going to cause them to look for other help if they can't get it from us, don't you think? And would that be China, quite possibly?
They're going to have to. And I mean, at this point, I take the Houthi threat a little bit personally, because they actually lobbed one of those projectiles at Riyadh the day I left in late October. So you do start to take notice. And I think, you know, what I learned in my extended stay in the kingdom this fall is, you know, that if you want to personalize your foreign policy and say it is all about one person, which apparently this administration's is, it's all about the king prince, or the crown prince, rather. And, you know, that is one individual who, you know, you can disagree with on various issues, but the relationship with Saudi Arabia goes back 70 years, and they have been one of our strongest, most important allies. And if you don't understand the value of that relationship and the significance of the kingdom for the region and globally, then you're going to be in for a world of long-term hurt. And you mentioned China. Obviously, China would be very, very eager to have a closer relationship with the kingdom, which is their single largest energy supplier. And, you know, one of the things China fears the most is the American energy dominance achieved through President Trump's energy renaissance. And that is, for them, a huge strategic advantage for us. And they would love to be able to move in closer with the Saudis to offset that, which is one reason, we can't abandon that relationship. So I think, I think, again, they're going to get mugged by reality as time goes on.
Well, I'd sadly, and again, you've spent time both in the region and in the Energy Department here focusing on the importance of that strategy of trying to create this abundance from the United States that would give us a measure of energy independence. That is another Trump policy that is over the side, of course, under the Biden administration. But let me turn to one other in the Middle East that's also worrying, and you kind of have touched on it, Victoria Coates, but the hostility of the Biden team to Israel seems to be pretty pronounced. The slights of not reaching out to Benjamin Netanyahu for, even just the most perfunctory of diplomatic niceties is just one symbolic example of it. But the Abraham Accords, the elevation of the Palestinians again, the fact that we are watching this aggressive appeasement of Iran, all is clearly at odds with Israel's security and almost certainly again is going to find repercussions, I think, with a critically important regional ally in our relationship with them. What do you think?
Oh, I think absolutely. And symbols are important. And again, they're personalizing this. It doesn't matter who the prime minister of Israel is. Israel is one of the most critical global allies to the United States. And the American taxpayer has made a historic investment in Israel. Our security partnership with them runs to about $4 billion a year. And that is over a 10-year period under the current memorandum of understanding. And I am all for that investment. I think it's paid off handsomely. But to suddenly posit that Israel doesn't matter or Israel is the problem in the region, when we are that integrally involved with them is just mind-blowing to me. I mean, it's taking a huge strategic asset and tossing it away for no reason.
And the big fear that I have, and I unfortunately will have to come back to you for another day's talk to visit at length about this, if you will, Victoria Coates, but I fear that whether it's by miscalculation or simple inadvertence or worse, the predictable consequences of these kinds of behavior on the part of the administration, we may well see this region plunge into an absolutely catastrophic conflict. And it could be avoided, it should be avoided, but it will require, I think, a restoration of Trump policies, not a pursuit of those that are so hostile to them. Victoria Coates, thank you for your time today. Thank you for joining us at the Center for Security Policy. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Debbie Georgiadis right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And what a pleasure to be able to say to a great friend of mine and much admired interlocutor with the American people. Special personal hello and welcome. Her name is Debbie Georgiadis. She is the host of a terrific podcast she calls America, Can We Talk? And she does that most days and does it with great effect. And I value our ability to pick her brains because she's got her finger on the pulse of what Americans are thinking, both in her native Texas and across the country. And it's great to have her back. Debbie, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Frank, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate that.
I wanted to pick your brains most immediately, Debbie, about something that you lived through, as did your fellow citizens of the state of Texas and, well, others across the South as a result of these terrible storms that took place in the past 2 weeks. Talk a bit about specifically, if you would, the impact that those freezing rainstorms and all that went along with the snow and the like, in terms of impacting the electric grid of Texas, which quite sensibly has its own grid, but it ceased to function most parts of the state for protracted periods of time. What was it like, and what are the takeaways from the experience for you and your colleagues?
Thank you. You know, the quick story on how it felt to be in Texas. This is beginning pretty much on Valentine's Day, Sunday, and then extending the following week. We had unseasonably cold temperatures, and we had snowstorms and ice storms, and all of this happened in a period of 5 days or so. There was some warning from public officials about the need to prepare for very cold weather, but no one anticipated, apparently, the impact on the Texas electric grid, because what happened very quickly was that the electric grid could not keep up with the demand for power in Texas for the millions, 26 million people live in Texas, basically, and everyone wanted to turn their heat on and have it up, and they quickly ran out. Well, what actually happened was they claim they came within 3 minutes or so of actually having the entire grid go down. But because they didn't want that to happen, they had to pull back and say certain areas were going to have power cut. And people kept thinking these were rolling blackouts, but they weren't. The decisions that were made that cut power to some areas, they couldn't shift it. They didn't have enough reserve energy in the system. And then they had a compounded problem with both the windmills here freezing up Texas has about 20% of our power come from sustainable sources like wind and solar. We had windmills go down. We had the solar panels collecting nothing because they were encased in ice and snow. But there was also a failure of the more traditional power in Texas. A nuclear plant lost half of its generation, massive failures in coal, oil. The Texas grid just wasn't ready for this storm.
And the effect of it, you say, for 5 days at least, in some areas, I think it was longer than that, it was essentially people were subsisting in sub-zero temperatures, was it? Or certainly sub-freezing temperatures, for protracted periods, days on end. And this just underscored something that you have been personally engaged in, as have I, Debbie, as has a mutual friend of ours, State Senator Bob Hall of Texas, trying to get the grid of that state, again, it's a freestanding one, made not only as reliable as it can be, but also resilient. What are the likely repercussions for that effort of this hard experience that you've all had, do you think?
You know, it's a great question, Frank, because as you are saying, we have had in Texas a small number of vocal members of the House and Senate and the Texas legislature trying to raise the issue of the Texas grid and its security, its ability to come back after an attack. And mostly those arguments have fought those, the argument that they need to be secured. We have to expend time and thought and money into making that grid more secure. Most of that's been met with deaf ears at the very least. In actual opposition. People just didn't think it was necessary. But now that this storm has happened, so Bob Hall, the Senator Bob Hall, has a bill he's introduced, I think, the last four times called the Resilient Energy Communities Legislation, saying we have to secure the grid. And, you know, in a really weird way, I was thinking about this morning, this was kind of a good dry run or a good example for the people of Texas, because this wasn't an intentional act by an enemy like China or any other enemy, which could actually take down a grid intentionally and try to keep it down. This was just to wake us up to say, look what happens if you lose power. Because quickly what happened in Texas, at least 35 people literally froze to death in their homes. They're saying more people likely, you know, people lost water because, well, for a variety of reasons. So they ran out of water, they ran out of power. It was a disaster and people really suffered. And now I think many citizens and legislators are awake to the need to actually do a fix.
Now, so when you say it's a good thing, it's not good that it happened, but it may be a wake-up call that could result in good things coming from it, good steps being taken, long overdue steps at that, and thereby perhaps sparing millions of Texans and perhaps others of us around the country if we learn from this experience and emulate Texas, you know, working the problem, as I hope it will, you know, to spare us possibly catastrophic consequences of a larger national grid down situation. Which brings me to a point. You mentioned China, Debbie. One of the upshots of the arrival in Washington of the Biden-Harris administration is, as you know, one of the first acts of Joe Biden was an executive order putting on hold an earlier executive order by Donald Trump saying we don't want foreign equipment in our electric grid. And specifically of concern is the fact that we've subsequently learned that there are now something between 200 and perhaps as many as 300 Chinese-manufactured large transformers in our grid, at least one of which I'm told is in Texas, possibly more. That's a huge vulnerability if the Chinese are able to manipulate or simply destroy those at will, perhaps through cyber techniques or backdoors or what have you. To the extent, Debbie, that this is now becoming a focus of concern in Texas, what do you make of the idea that Biden and company seem to think it's okay to have us keep foreign equipment in our grid and potentially put you all at risk of somebody intentionally bringing about something perhaps even worse than what you've just lived through?
Frank, I cannot conceive of a single good reason for what President Biden did, saying that America was not going to follow through on the President Trump initiative to get China and their potential to attack our electric grid, to protect America from the potential of China attacking our electric grid. There is no logical or sane argument for what President Biden did. I hope that their questions are asked about that. Why wouldn't you want to keep China out of prevent them from having any capacity to interfere with our grid? I certainly hope questions are asked of him and other people in Washington, because it's a very alarming picture that China, who's, as through your great work, Frank Gaffney, and many others, emerging in the minds of more and more Americans as a very serious potential threat to America's security. They have very strong mission in place right now to become the world's one singular superpower. And the idea that we would even want to have any capacity on their part to interfere with our grid. Because back to what you're saying about Texas, of course, it wasn't a good thing. It was a terrible thing that happened here. And your heart goes out to everybody who suffered so much. But it was a lesson for people who've in the past rejected the idea that we have to secure the grid, examine its vulnerabilities, and fix them. It's a fabulous thing that the people now see in just a miniature way from a snowstorm and not a nuclear attack or not an EMP attack, what can happen when the grid goes down.
Just a closing thought. There's a report out today. I don't know that it's been fully confirmed that China, in its ongoing struggle with India, has used its abilities to turn off the power in the city of Mumbai. So if true, this is yet another indication of the malevolence of the Chinese Communist Party, point one, but point two, the absolutely imperative need that we not let ourselves be made vulnerable to action by the Chinese of any kind that would affect our power grid and thereby perhaps our survival as a society. Debbie Georgiadis, thank you for the finger on the pulse that you have through your terrific podcast, America, Can We Talk? Thank you for sharing your insights with us from time to time, and I look forward to catching up with you again. I'm anxious to get your thoughts on Donald Trump's speech at CPAC last week and the future of this Great America movement. We'll talk with you about that and other things soon. I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.